Our third case this morning is United States against Scott.
May it please the court, Warren.
Please wait until we manage to get your adversary seated at the table. Mr. Haskin.
Warren Haskin, representing defendant Timothy Stotts. Stotts was indicted on 3 counts and convicted on 2. He was convicted of conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute cocaine and knowingly possessing with the intent to distribute cocaine. He was acquitted on count 3, which charged knowing possession with intent to distribute cocaine in a separate transaction on a later date. Most of the evidence against the defendant consisted of acts and words of persons other than the defendant. Defense counsel asked the trial judge to instruct the jury that only the defendant's own acts and words showed whether he joined a conspiracy, and the judge declined to give that instruction. Defendant contends that this failure was error and that defendant's conviction on conspiracy should be reversed. Moreover, defendant contends that the trial court's failure to properly instruct the jury on the conspiracy charge undermined not only the conviction on count 1, the conspiracy count, but the conviction on count 2, the possession count.
Mr. Haskin, doesn't the proposed instruction suggest that the jury may not consider the statements of co-conspirators in trying to determine exactly what Mr. Stotts did or said?
The proposed instruction, Your Honor, says co-conspirator statements determined to be admissible by the trial judge may be considered by the jury to decide what the defendant did and said or to help understand the defendant's own acts and words.
But it is only the defendant's own acts and words upon which the jury can rely for evidence that the defendant was a member of the conspiracy. That's the rest of the instruction.
That's the rest of the instruction. That's a close paraphrase of the instruction that's been approved by this court in 3 separate cases since 1991. The United States versus Martinez de Ortiz in 1991, United States versus Torres in 1992, United States versus Goines in 1993.
Well, all of those cases say, it seems to me, is that while only the defendant's own words or acts may be considered to determine whether he was a member of the conspiracy, a jury may consider properly admitted statements of co-conspirators to determine what the defendant did or said, or to help understand the defendant's words or acts.
But that's exactly what the proposed instruction said.
Not exactly.
It may be considered by the jury to decide what the defendant did and said.
Well, we're reading it differently, Mr. Haskin.
I don't understand what the difference is. It says that may be considered by the co-conspirator statements may be considered by the jury to decide what the defendant did and said. I don't see the inconsistency. I think that's exactly what the court said in 1991 in United States versus Martinez de Ortiz. To go on, in those 3 cases, the court held that a matter of substantive law, membership in a conspiracy depends upon the accused's own acts and words. In this case, most of the evidence against the defendant consisted of acts and words of other persons. In all 3 of those cases that I've mentioned, the convictions were upheld. In the D. Ortiz case, the instruction was given. The case came to this court because the instructions given did not explain to the jury the difference between the evidence, the use of the evidence to decide whether the defendant joined the conspiracy and the relevance of the evidence for other purposes. However, since the jury acquitted the defendant of the possession count, the court in that case held that the instruction actually favored the defendant and therefore affirmed the conviction. In the next case, the Torres case, the instruction was refused, but the Court of Appeals, this court, nevertheless affirmed the conviction because another instruction adequately informed the jury that statements of other persons should be used only to decide what the defendant Torres did or said. The other instruction was that each defendant was entitled to have his case determined from his own conduct and from the evidence applicable to him. This instruction was not given in this case. The third case is the Goins case, where the instruction was also refused. The court upheld the conviction because other instructions led the court to believe that the jury would have reached the same decision had they received more complete guidance. The other instructions were that separate consideration should be given to each defendant, and that the jury should consider testimony of informants, quote, with great caution and great care. That instruction was not given in this case. The court went on to say that district courts, quote, could avoid the need for this line of review by carefully instructing juries on this confusing but important issue, guided by the analysis in D'Ortiz. The other instructions that were given in Goins were not given in the present case. The defendant also contends that the error with respect to the conspiracy count undermined the conviction of possession as well. The jury could hardly have decided otherwise in light of the instruction that a conspirator is responsible for offenses committed by his fellow conspirators. So once the jury decided that the defendant was guilty of conspiracy, it was quite natural for the jury to decide that the defendant was also guilty of possession, even though the possession was by one of the co-conspirators. I will save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Haskins. Ms. Jacobs.
Good morning. May it please the court, Michelle Jacobs for the United States. I think the place to start is with Judge Rovner's first question, and that is whether or not the defendant's submission of the jury instruction was a proper statement of the law. And while I would agree with Mr. Haskin that the beginning of the submission may have been leading to a proper statement of the law, the problem he has is with that last clause starting, but it is only the defendant's acts and words. And so for that reason, the government submits that because the defendant's requested instruction was not a proper statement of the law, the district court was certainly not required to give it. Now, having said that, I would also acknowledge that in the cases that Mr. Haskin has cited, it is certainly said, this court has said repeatedly, that it is advisable, excuse me, for the district court to instruct the jury on what is clearly a confusing area of the law. And so, in the end, would it have been better for Judge Adelman to have given a correct instruction on this issue? Perhaps. But it is certainly not plain error, and it certainly does not require reversal of Mr. Scott's conviction that the court did not. I'm not going to go into the challenge of count one any further unless the court has questions. The only thing that I want to get into on count two, and it's not something that Mr. Haskin has specifically raised in his oral argument, nor did the government specifically raise in its brief, but I think it's important. Number one, I looked briefly as I was sitting in the back of the courtroom before the argument at the closing arguments again, just to make sure that I was properly going to state the theory of the government's case. And it's very clear at page 399 that the government in no way relied on a vicarious liability theory in the conviction on count two. The government specifically argued the aiding and abetting theory. The instructions on aiding and abetting and joint venture were given. Now, having said that, the vicarious liability instruction was also given, and I need to, at some level, confess error. I don't think it is error ultimately in the case. But if the court looks at the instruction that the government submitted and that the court ultimately gave, the vicarious liability instruction is wrong. And that's why there is no possibility, I don't think, that the jury relied on a vicarious liability theory on count two. It indicates that if the jury were to find that the defendant was guilty on count one, was a co-conspirator, and that if his co-conspirators then committed the offense other offenses, he would be vicariously liable. But it says that he would be guilty against count one. It doesn't reference counts two and three. I mean, I think it was just a typographical error, I assume. But ultimately, the jury was not instructed that it could find the defendant guilty of count two if it found him guilty of count one. So that, in conjunction with the government relying solely on the aiding and abetting theory, even if this court were to find there's some error in count one, I don't think count two would be reversible. But as I said at the beginning, there was no error with regard to count one, certainly no plain error. And so if this court has no questions of me on these either of these challenges, I would request that the court affirm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Jacobs.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Haskin?
Thank you. As to count one, I would simply repeat that the defendants requested instruction number 39, which is an appendix to my brief, is a very close paraphrase of the instruction that has been approved in three separate cases by this court. And I think that that instruction should have been given. As far as count two is concerned, I believe that, as I mentioned, it was quite natural for the jury, having decided that based on the erroneousness or the failure to give the instruction that should have been given, that the defendant was guilty of conspiracy, it was quite natural for the jury to decide that the defendant was also guilty of possession based on the fact that his alleged co-conspirators actually had possession and delivered possession of the cocaine to the government informant. Unless the panel has any questions, I would simply ask that the case be reversed and remanded for a new trial.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Haskin. And Mr. Haskin, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and to the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.